This is The Stark Truth, hosted by Robert Stark. Brought to you by StarkTruthRadio.com. Robert Stark is an American journalist and political commentator. You can listen to his podcast at www.StarkTruthRadio.com.
This is Robert Stark. I'm joined here with Keith Preston. We're going to be discussing the recent Best Buy scandal with the FBI, issues involving online censorship such as YouTube. Keith, great having you back on the show.
Good to be back, Robert.
So there was this news article about Best Buy, about their Geek Squad, and I've actually read about this about a year or two ago, but this was recently a major news item. So what's been happening is the Geek Squad, which repairs computers at Best Buy, they have a program with the FBI where apparently some of the Geek Squad are official FBI informants, but they're obviously, I mean, under federal law, computer repairmen are required to report any kind of child pornography. But this goes way beyond this. They actually do a special investigation, and they're trained by the FBI to search everyone's computer. And whatever you think about whether, I mean, even if you think people who use child pornography should be punished severely, what's really despicable about this is they're treating your average person who's just going in to get a repair like a criminal. And this came to light with a case of a man. He was a doctor in Orange County, California, who was he was charged with child pornography by getting his computer inspected by the Geek Squad. But what actually happened is the judge in the case dismissed all charges because the judge decided that the evidence was conducted in an illegitimate manner, violating his Fourth Amendment rights.
Well, you summarized the basic issues of this situation pretty well. The issue is that the FBI was actively soliciting private computer techs that are employed by a private company, which is Best Buy, for the purpose of recruiting them and training them as informants and paying them for all of this, with their assignment being to search the computers of any people whose computers they serviced to see if there's any child pornography on the computer. Now, child pornography, as you said, is illegal. It's not considered to be anything that's protected by the First Amendment or anything like that. It's considered contraband. So there's no right to have child pornography legally. But what was being done with these Geek Squad computer techs is they were essentially working as law enforcement agents. They were, because they were being trained, recruited, and paid by the FBI, they were essentially law enforcement agents. And when they were conducting searches of private computers when they had been contracted to simply do repair work, what they were essentially doing was conducting the equivalent of a police search. It's no different than the police coming to your house and searching your house for contraband, you know, child pornography.
But not only that, they're treating everyone like a criminal.
Yeah, well, that's a big problem with this, because it would be like if the police decided, well, okay, we have a high crime rate in this particular community, so we're just going to go house to house and randomly search every house to see if there's, you know, illegal weapons, illegal drugs, illegal pornography, anything of that nature. That's what was really happening here. Now, the problem is that under the Fourth Amendment to the Constitution, the law is that for law enforcement to conduct a search of private property, whether it's a computer or someone's person or a house or a business or whatever, they're supposed to have a duly executed search warrant, meaning that there's a huge body of case law behind this that goes all the way back to the 19th century. But the general principle is to conduct a legal search, there has to be probable cause for law enforcement to suspect that a crime has taken place. They have to present this evidence to a judge or a magistrate who executes a warrant, and then they can actually go and conduct a search, and they have to have a duly authorized warrant. They have to be able to present a warrant to the person whose property is going to be searched. Now, there are exceptions to that. For example, if it's a situation where, for example, there's the plain view doctrine. That's where, say, a policeman pulls somebody over for a traffic ticket and they've got an illegal weapon sitting on the passenger side of their car in the seat in plain view. Or a situation where it's a hot pursuit where, you know, somebody is fleeing the police and they go and hide in a house or something like that. You know, the police can conduct a search in a situation like that. So there are exceptions, you know, based on circumstances. But just to go and conduct a search of somebody's property at random just because there's, you know, you think there's some kind of possibility that this person could have contraband is not legal under the Fourth Amendment. Again, it's no different than if the police were hiring private security guards. You know, let's say a good analogy would be this. Let's say that in the name of curbing drug trafficking or illegal drug use or illegal weapons, let's say the FBI or the DEA or one of these federal police agencies were to go out and start hiring people who go into people's homes to service people's homes. Like, let's say they were hiring plumbers and TV repairmen and computer repairmen and, you know, home cleaning service employees and home health aid employees, and saying, yeah, okay, you folks, you know, we're going to pay you, we're going to train you, and every time you go into somebody's home to, you know, clean the carpet or whatever, we want you to look around and see if there's any illegal drugs or any illegal pornography or any illegal weapons or, you know,
plus,
anything else.
Since Geek Squad, since they're being paid as informants, hypothetically, they could have an incentive to plant something on someone's computer. I mean, that could happen.
Well, sure, that's another thing, because they're essentially getting a bounty for the work that they're doing. That's a tactic that has been used in law enforcement through the in many circumstances. One thing that law enforcement will do to cultivate informants is pay informants. Now, informants are not law enforcement agents. These are just private citizens who are recruited as informants, and often they will be paid for their services. It's something that's controversial in law enforcement, and a lot of civil liberties advocates are opposed to this because they say that's the problem. If you are paying someone to dig up dirt on someone, well, guess what? They're going to dig up dirt on someone. So they have this incentive to plant evidence and things like that as well. So that's certainly an issue. You know, these, what was happening was that the FBI was essentially deputizing private computer repair people to search other people's property without the other person's consent and without a duly executed search warrant. And that means that these computer repair people from Geek Squad or whatever had every motivation potentially to plant evidence on someone's computer illegally, dishonestly. That's one possibility. But even without that consideration, though, even without that, there's still the issue of the Fourth Amendment violation that's taking place.
And I remember a while back, there was some bill sponsored by Debbie Wasserman Schultz and some Republican from Texas saying that anyone who is a child pornography suspect, that the government should have access to their entire internet search history. I forget the specific name of the bill, but do you remember when that came up?
Well, there's a number of bits and pieces of legislation like that have been enacted. One thing we need to consider when we look at this is that it's not just child pornography cases where these kinds of issues come up. A far more significant consideration is terrorism and organized crime and drug trafficking and things like that, because there's a range of federal laws and state laws as well that attempt to get around the Fourth Amendment for the purpose of conducting exactly these kinds of searches. The Patriot Act is the most obvious and famous example, but there are others as well. So that's really the issue. The issue is, to what degree does the state have arbitrary search powers or arbitrary surveillance powers of other people's property or person? It can be child pornography, it can be drugs, it can be weapons, it can be terrorism suspects, it can be...
Well, it seems to be that terrorism and child pornography are the two things that get the most reaction. A lot of the political dissidents blame all political problems. Both on the populist left and the populist right, they talk about these elites who are out of touch of the mainstream. But I would just say that a lot of these issues are politicians pandering to voters, like you're kind of hysterical, like soccer moms. And it's not so much the public is hysterical about these issues, so the public is willing to sort of go along with any kind of draconian police state if it protects them from things like terrorism or child pornography.
Yeah, well, these are obviously things that most people think are terrible, you know, using children in pornography, child molestation, and the things that go along with that, as well as terrorism as well. It's, you know, very few people are for these kinds of things. I guess the people that do it are, but other than that, most people are certainly not. So it makes sense on one hand that a lot of people are going to say, oh, well, these are all bad things, so of course there should be all these kinds of surveillance or enforcement powers to try to eradicate these, but the thing is, that's the same argument you can make about any kind of crime. I mean, why not apply that standard to armed robbers or burglars or, you know, just routine criminals or anyone else? The main concern, though, beyond civil liberties issues like the Fourth Amendment, is the potential use of these kinds of tactics for political repression. It's certainly possible that the FBI could and would recruit informants of these kinds, you know, whether it's computer repair people or, again, some of the other examples I gave, home cleaning services or whatever. It's certainly possible that all the people in any of these kinds of professions could be recruited as what amounted to a private spy network that was operated by federal law enforcement. In fact, that's how it's been done in some instances. In East Germany, there was the famous example of the Stasi, where at one point a huge percentage of the population were actually being recruited as informants and informing each other and things like that. Now, that's kind of an extreme situation, but that's the real issue, is to what degree should law enforcement organizations have the authority to go out and simply recruit people off the street for the purpose of conducting surveillance and espionage of other people in ways that would violate the Fourth Amendment if professional law enforcement did it, and as this judge apparently decided, does violate the Fourth Amendment, because these private computer repair people were acting on behalf of law enforcement.
Do you think hypothetically it could be an issue as far as planting this kind of material on political dissidents? I heard that it happened to one of the enemies of the Clintons back in the 90s, but I forget the name of the person.
Yeah, well, that's the reason why these kinds of things are illegal in the first place. I mean, the whole reason that in the Constitution there is the things like the Fourth Amendment that requires duly executed search warrants and all of these things is so these kinds of investigations can't be used for political reasons. If we didn't have the Fourth Amendment, then law enforcement or whomever would be able to go to someone's home or place of business or get on their computer or whatever and plant anything they wanted. It wouldn't have to be child pornography. They could certainly frame someone for possessing child pornography, and they could do that with drugs and illegal weapons and bomb-making materials or anything else they wanted to try to charge someone with a crime or eliminate them because they're unwanted political opposition. And
I mean, there's the issue of political dissidents. I've also heard law enforcement does this with people who they pretty much know as criminals, but they want to get rid of. So say there's a drug dealer and they don't have evidence on them, so they plant drugs. Or say there's a convicted child molester and they don't have evidence to convict them, so they might plant child porn on them. That's another scenario.
Yeah, yeah, that cases like that happen, and that's illegal. When law enforcement does that, if it can be shown that they've done that, that's illegal. But it is a tactic that's used at time, and again, that's why the Fourth Amendment and things like that exist, as a safeguard against these kinds of things.
And also ties in with the whole issue of the whole collusion between corporations and the police state. Best Buy is one example. You also see this with Google. And Google keeping surveillance of people's internet search history. There's all kinds of examples of collusion between corporations and the tech industry with the police state and surveillance state.
Yeah, and that's a serious problem, because what is happening is that in a country like the United States that has a First Amendment protection for freedom of speech, freedom of the press, freedom of religion, all these things, as well as the other procedural rights, the Fourth Amendment and all that, what's happening is that the government is trying to farm out state repression to the private sector, because censorship that's imposed by the private sector is not considered to be in violation of the Fourth Amendment. Private companies and all of that can censor anything they want. And so what is happening is that you have companies like the technology companies and so forth that are, or social media companies that are, using their position to censor the exchange of ideas or the communication of ideas that they don't like or that the government doesn't like or whatever. You see this going on in the corporate world. You also see it going on in the university system. The university system has their speech codes and all of these kinds of things as well. That's the same thing. They try to claim that, we're not really imposing censorship. You know, instead we're just trying to avoid creating a hostile environment or whatever. But that's really what's happening in our own society, is that instead of having formalized state censorship, we're having a situation where censorship is being farmed out to corporations, to universities, and other institutions. There's not that many examples right now of the state itself actually being a threat to free speech directly. The one big exception that I know of are the efforts to undermine the Boycott Israel movement. There have been efforts, serious legislation introduced in Congress and all of that, as well as in some local and state levels, to undermine the BDS, the Boycott Israel movement. But that's the main example that I know of where the state itself is a direct threat to political freedom or free speech or whatever.
Yeah, it's more corporations. I mean, I was listening to an alt-right podcast with Richard Spencer, and he was saying part of the reason he supports a basic income and nationalized health care because it would free up more political dissidents, because a lot of people keep their views to themselves because they don't want to lose their jobs. Most of the oppression of free speech is through the private sector.
Well, the position that I have on this question is that I consider corporations to be the economic branch of the government. The mass corporations, certainly the large technology companies, would not exist, and certainly not in their present form, if it were not for a huge range of protections they get from the state, ranging from things that are very basic, like the legal doctrine of corporate personhood, limited liability, not to mention R&D subsidies or tax breaks and all kinds of other things. I tend to lean towards the view that corporations that receive these kinds of state-supported legal assistance should be subject to the First Amendment as well. Sean Gabb, who was a British libertarian writer, has written an essay about this where he was arguing that companies that want the protection of the state when it comes to corporate personhood laws, laws of incorporation, limited liability, all these very basic things that create corporations as institutional entities apart from their individual owners, where it's not just a partnership or an individual proprietor or family business anymore. It's an institutional entity that has a legal life of its own. Once a corporation grows to that size or accepts these kinds of legal protections, the First Amendment or the Constitution generally should apply to corporations as well as to government. I would say the same thing about universities. Universities should be protected under the protection of the Constitution as well. Certainly if they are state-owned and operated universities, I might make an exception for, say, religious-oriented colleges that are private colleges or something like that. But, the overwhelming majority of colleges and universities are either state-owned or operated or heavily subsidized in the state through direct grants and subsidies or student loans.
Because when it really comes down to it, it doesn't matter so much whether it's public or private. What matters is how powerful the institution is. And in some of these European countries, they have government-sponsored hate speech laws where the government can fine you and put you in jail for the wrong speech. But with the private sector, it can be just as oppressive. I mean, you're not going to end up in jail, but if you have the wrong views, they can destroy you economically, you can lose your job, they can basically make it so you have no public platform on social media. I mean, social media is the main vehicle for getting your views across. I know there's alternatives like Gab, but pretty much most of the political activity goes on the major sites like YouTube and Facebook. So if you're shut down, then you don't have a voice. And there's this political candidate, Nalin, who's running against Paul Ryan. And he was saying in an interview that he would support legislation saying that the state should mandate freedom of speech on social media. Are you familiar with that concept, and Nalin?
Oh, I'm not familiar with this particular candidate or individual, but I'm familiar with the idea. Yeah, the idea is just what I was saying.
Ironically, it used to be more of a leftist issue, but recently it's been taken up by the alt-right.
Yeah, well, yeah, it used to be that free speech was very much the left's issue. A few decades ago, most people that were out there supporting free speech were groups like the ACLU that would, at least at that time, they would defend free speech for all kinds of people, including non-leftists. The ACLU defended the right of neo-Nazi groups to have public marches. They defended free speech for a lot of other people that were considered unsavory or whatever. Nowadays, though, what's happened is that the left has more or less moved away from the free speech paradigm more towards the social justice paradigm, meaning that any kind of speech that undermines or is seen to conflict with social justice objectives is considered illegitimate speech and therefore shouldn't be protected.
Even as far as internet surveillance goes, I mean, I'm relatively young, but I can remember during the Bush administration how the left was outraged over government surveillance and the Patriot Act. Now we have Trump in charge, and there are legitimate areas to criticize Trump, but the left is not really even talking about that. Everything about the modern day left is just that Trump is a racist, Trump is a misogynist, but they're not even talking about issues like internet surveillance anymore. Most of the people talking about internet surveillance are either libertarians or on the dissident right.
Yeah, that's true. Even when Bill Clinton was president, there was legislation that was enacted at the time called the Communications Decency Act, and it was enacted by Congress, and it was largely about trying to block the distribution of pornography on the internet.
And so this was primarily the Republicans and Newt Gingrich pushing this?
Yeah. Well, that's how it used to be. It used to be that the big pro-censorship people tended to be the political right. They viewed free speech as just something that was giving cover to communists and subversives and pornographers and whatever else. Nowadays, you hear the same kind of thing coming from the left. Free speech is just giving cover to racists and sexists and fascists and homophobes and all these other folks. So it's really the mirror image of that, only from the other direction. And I think that represents a shift in the balance of power in society. The political left, or at least the cultural left, is a lot more powerful now than it was a few decades ago. And that's normal. When movements and groups start becoming powerful, they start losing interest in any kind of libertarian-oriented values because they look like they don't need, they, you know, they feel like they don't need that anymore. You know, communists will often be zealous proponents of free speech when out of power, as will Nazis and other groups that normally favor an authoritarian form of government once they actually have power. And that's really what's happened with the left in recent years.
And we've talked about this countless times, but it's the same with economic issues. Bernie Sanders' campaign was primarily about the class issues and economics, but the liberal establishment has abandoned traditional working class issues.
Yeah, well, the only sector of the left today that has any real influence is the cultural left, that is the race, gender, gay, identity politics left. The working class-oriented, union, labor-oriented left has very little influence. The civil liberties left has very little influence. The anti-war left has very little influence. The environmental left is pretty influential in many ways. But the foreign policy left, none of that really has much influence anymore. I mean, the left today has largely become dominated by the identity politics paradigm, and all the other stuff has kind of been swept to the side along the way.
Yeah, you know, as far as the anti-war thing, I remember when Trump launched those missile strikes against Syria, there was very little opposition from the left. Ironically, the only opposition was from the alt-right, who were originally pro-Trump.
Yeah, that's interesting. In fact, a lot of the mainstream center liberal left actually became more sympathetic to Trump after the attack on Syria. You do have still a far left that is a genuine anti-imperialist left that's out there, but this is not the mainstream of the left, and it's certainly not the mainstream of liberalism. And the attack on Syria was actually seen by a lot of liberals as a positive thing. You know, they viewed it the same way they viewed Obama's attack on Libya, you know, sort of a human rights imperialism or whatever. The old-fashioned, you know, anti-war left has been very much marginalized on the left. You know, the anti-war left that came out of the Vietnam War era and then out of the Central American War era in the 80s, that's gone now. What you have today is a center left that's very big on the use of military power, ostensibly for the purpose of protecting human rights and that kind of thing. There is an anti-imperialist left, but it's very marginal.
Yeah, back to the issue with Best Buy. I read about the issue on a number of mainstream sites. I mean, I don't know whether you call them mainstream or not, but a major sites ranging from Breitbart to the Huffington Post. Would you say most of the outrage was from the dissident right or the dissident left to that whole Best Buy scandal?
It's hard to say because I've, as far as the news reports I've seen, most of the news reports have been from fairly centrist sources, and some of which have been actually very sympathetic to this. I know I saw some commentary from some commentators, I think from USA Today, that were expressing a fairly sympathetic view of this. So I would imagine that anyone that has a dissenting point of view would be suspicious of this because, you know, those, you know, people who are political dissidents are more likely to be targeted for repression by federal law enforcement. That's just how it works. So I can't imagine that either the genuine far left or the alt-right would be particularly enamored of this.
I know there was some controversy because the early ACLU was defending pedophile organizations back in the 70s and 80s, and back then it was seen as a radical leftist cause, and conservatives were outraged. There was some controversy about the ACLU defending NAMBLA.
To my knowledge, the ACLU has never defended. I may be wrong about this because it's not something that I'm, you know, really that up on. But to my knowledge, the ACLU has never really defended the right to use children in pornography, because that spills over into other kinds of crimes like child sexual abuse.
So with the whole thing with NAMBLA, they weren't endorsing criminal behavior. They were just defending their right to freedom of association.
Exactly. They were defending their right to exist as an organization and to advocate for their views. Basically they believe that sex between adults and underage people, I'm not sure if they want to do away with the, if NAMBLA wants to do away with the age of consent entirely or reduce it to a very low.
A really long time ago, I actually interviewed an FBI agent who infiltrated them. This was one of my first interviews. This was like 10 years ago. And his name is Bob Hammer. He claims that when he infiltrated them, they wanted to abolish the age of consent altogether.
Yeah, well, that's not surprising. I don't know if that's the line they take publicly, but I wouldn't be surprised if they took that position. I mean, they are a pro-pedophile organization, but the ACLU, though, was big on defending their right to free speech, to advocate for their views. I think that's the main thing. The ACLU was also criticized by people on the left, even back in the 70s, for defending the right of the American Nazi Party. Well, it was actually the National Socialist Party in America, which was a splinter from the American Nazi Party.
Was this about the whole march of the neo-Nazis in that Jewish area of suburban Chicago?
Yeah, in Skokie, Illinois, yeah. But the ACLU sided with the neo-Nazis in that case. And they were widely criticized for that. In fact, I think something like a third of their membership left because of that. But they would defend other, somewhat unpopular people. When Oliver North was involved in the Iran-Contra scandal, the ACLU defended his Fifth Amendment rights, arguing that the criminal prosecution of him had been in violation of the immunity he was supposed to be given for his testimony in front of Congress. Nowadays, from what I've seen, the ACLU is increasingly just an ideologically left-wing organization. I don't know how many cases that they take nowadays, if any, that are outside the...
Yeah, they're mostly... They primarily seem to be concerned about illegal immigration amnesty, but they've abandoned all their traditional issues of internet privacy and all that stuff.
Yeah, I was looking at their website recently, and they seem to me to have moved over into the kind of identity politics milieu and made that a focus of their issues. I mean, they still take fairly civil libertarian issues positions on a lot of issues, but that doesn't really seem to be their focus. They seem to be more about the immigrants' rights thing, the defending affirmative action, and they were always big on defending, say, abortion rights to the nth degree and all that kind of stuff as well. So that seems to be more their issues.
And then when it comes to the police and the whole Black Lives Matter thing, is the whole leftists who are sympathetic to Black Lives Matter, they're more concerned about your just sort of like rank and file cop who has to work in the ghetto, but they don't talk as much about the FBI and the whole surveillance state. They're more focused on like a police officer who gets into an altercation with the black criminal, but they don't. You would never hear them talking about the whole federal surveillance state, and the issue of the federal surveillance state has been sort of abandoned by the left, and that's something more that the dissident right is concerned about. But the faction of the left that is anti-police, they're focused more on your just rank-and-file cop.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I've noticed that for years. In fact, I would say the problem is worse than that, in the sense that the Black Lives Matter types are actually for granting more power to federal law enforcement. What they want is to essentially nationalize law enforcement, because the image that they have is of the police being localized, police, municipal police or rural southern police. They identify the police with Bull Connor, the kind of racist redneck, sheriffs and that kind of thing from the civil rights era that would try to bust up civil rights marches and things like that. and then the federal government would come in to enforce civil rights. So that's really the kind of model that the Black Lives Matter and groups like that are operating on. They don't necessarily see the federal government as the enemy. In fact, they often see that as a preferable alternative to local law enforcement, which they think is, you know, infiltrated or embedded with racists and that kind of thing. So, yeah, those kinds of groups are not really much help when it comes to these kinds of issues. That is, the construction of this federal police state that's, based on mass surveillance and unconstitutional searches and things like that.
And in some cases, I mean, there was that case in South Carolina where a police officer shot a black man in cold blood. But the leftist, there have also been cases where there have been black criminals that have lunged at the police and the police have fought back. So they just have this, they automatically side with a black criminal against the police, and they have no nuance in the case.
Yeah, that's true. I've noticed that about a lot of these cases, that it's a lot of the actual cases that have led to the protests against police brutality and stuff like that, you know, some of them I have thought that the protesters were correct. Others, I thought it was more dubious, or perhaps the police officers may have even been in the right. Like the one example was the case in Baltimore where the guy died in a police van and six police officers were prosecuted. I think three of them were actually black police officers, and they were acquitted by the judge at trial. I don't know that they did anything wrong per se in that case in terms of something that would be considered illegal police brutality. Police brutality certainly happens. I mean, on my own Facebook page, I post a lot of videos of cases involving police brutality and excessive police conduct. Some of it may be in certain subject to interpretation, but it is a problem. I mean, it is a real issue. Blacks and other groups, that is the inner city or lower income.
Well, that's the thing, is there's also a class divide, because police issues involving just your rank and file police disproportionately affect blacks and the proletariat. When it comes to the FBI and internet surveillance, that affects the middle class, and not just political dissidents, but just regular middle class people. Like the Best Buy scandal, that's an issue involving, the guy involved in that whole child porn bust, I mean, he was a doctor, so he was very successful. So there is also kind of a class divide where you see rank-and-file cops dealing with the proletariat and the federal surveillance state surveilling the middle class. Would you say that's accurate?
Yeah, and this is something I've been saying for a while, is that the police state that we have in the United States is something that transcends all of these usual boundaries, left, right, class, race, all of these kinds of things, for exactly the reasons that you mentioned. More and more, the police state has gotten so large that it's crept into all areas of society. A lot of people, when they think of police brutality or police repression or whatever, they think of, a cop beating up a black guy with a baton in the inner city or something like that, or they think of something that's on the margins where there's like a standoff between federal agents and some more marginal group like the Branch Davidians or the people at the Bundy Ranch or whatever. But more and more, we're seeing these kinds of things spread into the conventional middle class and even affluent and wealthy classes. One example is some years back, there was a police raid, a SWAT team raid on the home of a mayor in a Maryland town. And it was one of those cases where they ended up shooting the dog, but it turned out they had the wrong house. They had the wrong address. And increasingly, you're starting to see more and more conventional, respectable, middle-class type people that are victims of these kinds of things, as opposed to the more marginalized and lower socioeconomic level people that were always the ones that experienced this in the past. So this is something that's going on at every level now.
Yeah, I have a friend, I don't know if you've heard of him, Charles Lincoln. He used to be he's a disbarred attorney, but he was a lawyer in this town called Lago Vista. It's a suburb of Austin, and he was suing the local police there, but that was a wealthy community, and there were incidences of a bunch of rich teenagers being obnoxious on a golf course, and a bunch of police officers coming in and beating them up. So that was a community that was a wealthy, basically all-white community, and you had issues of police brutality.
Yeah, sure. And that kind of thing is becoming more common. And the issue, I think, is the militarization of the police that's happened in the last, 40 years or so under the war on drugs, under the war on crime, under anti-gang police activity, and then under the war on terrorism. And increasingly, the police powers have been expanded into all these areas, as well as prosecutorial powers and things like that. So that's why we're seeing this kind of stuff happen now.
Where do you see the Attorney General's office going? What direction do you see them going under Jeff Sessions and the Trump administration?
Jeff Sessions is not a friend of anybody who cares about civil liberties or constitutional rights on any level. Regardless of what the rest of your political views are, whether you're a conservative or liberal, libertarian, all right, any of these other things. Jeff Sessions is an authoritarian to the bone. He wants to not only continue but escalate the war on drugs, which has probably been the worst policy for civil liberties in American history. He wants to continue the asset forfeiture program, which is arguably illegal under the Constitution. There's probably very little in the way of constitutional rights or civil liberties that he's would actually defend. Now, as to how successful he's going to be with all this, I don't really know, because he seems to be antagonizing Trump quite a bit. Lately, there seems to have been a falling out between Sessions and Trump, and I wouldn't be surprised if Trump ends up forcing Sessions out at some point. But definitely, he's not somebody you want to have as the Attorney General.
Well, I don't view Sessions as corrupt. I just think he's someone who has kind of old-school Southern values, and he genuinely believes in, law and order. I see him more as that kind of type, as opposed to someone who's just corrupt.
Well, either one's just as bad. I mean, I don't know that that's preferable. I mean, because it's still going to produce the same results.
But he's generally well-liked on the dissident right because of his strong stance on immigration. I know he is suing California over the sanctuary state status.
Yeah. That may be a bit short-sighted, though. I mean, endorsing a guy like that, for the sake of expediency on a particular issue is probably not a good plan, but that is true. He is popular on the right for that reason.
And as far as that issue goes, do you see that as a states' right issue, or are you sympathetic to Jeff Sessions' position?
Well, I tend to be for the autonomy of local and regional government generally, for any reason. For example, when it comes to the, a lot of your right-leaning listeners aren't going to like this, but I would say if individual cities want to be sanctuary cities, so be it. Or if individual states want to be sanctuary states, so be it. Now, I would also say the opposite is true. For example, when Obama had his program of refugee relocation, where he was trying to force the states to take in refugees from the war in Syria and other places, about 30 of the state governments said, no, we're not going to do that. I mean, I would have defended their right to take that position as well. So it's not really a pro versus anti-immigration thing. It's more just the idea of a local power versus central power.
So you're saying that the pro-amnesty side can have their sanctuary cities and the racialists can have freedom of association if they want an all-white community, like everyone gets their own communities?
Right, exactly, yes.
So as far as this whole debate about California being a sanctuary state and the whole Calexit movement, which is about creating a California republic, I mean, on principle, I'm sympathetic to regional autonomy and pan-secessionism, but as a Californian, I've seen a situation where basically the elites of California have elected a new people, and the traditional middle class, the traditional basically white middle class of California, they didn't have a say about that. I mean, they supported Prop 187. So it is a secessionist, pan-secessionist movement, but I see it more as a coalition between the Silicon Valley elites and the growing third world immigration population. So it's not, I don't view it as an organic movement as, say, the Southern Secessionists or the whole Quebec movement. So I have some degree of mixed feelings about that.
Yeah, well, what has happened in California is that California has become pretty much in the same vein as Latin American countries. Joel Kotkin, the social scientist, has actually written about that. He calls it California feudalism. And what has happened to California is exactly the same thing that we find traditionally in Latin American nations, where you have the super rich on one hand and this underclass of very poor people on the other hand. And the middle class is largely non-existent. And that's where the California economy largely is nowadays. You have, you know, in places like Hollywood and Malibu and the Bay Area and Silicon Valley, you have people that are as wealthy as people anywhere. You know, they're just like the wealthy elites in Latin America, in Rio and Sao Paulo and Mexico City and places like that. But along with that, you have this growing class of very poor people. In fact, there's been research that shows that in California now you have pockets of poverty that are as extreme as what you find in sub-Saharan Africa, which is really rather astounding, places like the Congo. So that's exactly what has happened to California. Now, as far as the idea of Cal Exit, I actually wrote an article about Cal Exit for Jared Taylor's American Renaissance probably about a year and a half ago. It was after the Trump election. It was right after the Trump election, so late 2016, I guess. It's online. I'm sure it's still online. But the thing is, though, I think there's now a isn't there now a secession movement in California among some of the other regions of California?
There's a movement called New California, and it would be a movement basically the inland counties of California that are more moderate to conservative breaking off.
Well, that's more or less what I would be in favor of. I'd be all for Cal Exit, and then I'd be for these people going their own way as well. And that would be true of other places. You know, I'd be all for New York seceding from the United States, and then New York City and the rest of the state seceding from each other. That's fine, and keep it going. So I don't really side with any particular ideological perspective when it comes to these things.
I don't know. I mean, I'm sympathetic to secessionist movements if they're based in a strong-rooted identity of having people living there over several generations, but I'm not as inclined to support Calexit. With a lot of conservatives living in red states, their attitude is good riddance, like California, like go. And I hear them like joke about California just like having a big earthquake and sinking into the sea. But it's still, for me, I actually have to live here, so
don't want any earthquakes. Yeah.
No,
yeah.
Of course not. Yeah.
That's totally understandable. That's totally understandable. I get that. Well, you know, there's a lot of issues like that. Like even with the secession movements in Europe, with Brexit, you know, I was sympathetic to Brexit. You know, I like the idea of breaking up the EU by having some of its influential members leave. I knew British people who were actually against Brexit on the grounds that the British state itself might actually be worse than the European Union. And so that was an interesting argument.
Exactly. Sometimes I mean, this goes against your whole pan-secessionist ideas, but if Jeff Sessions were to come into California and crack down in the sanctuary state, I'd be pretty pleased about that. So sometimes with politics, you can't be totally principled. Sometimes you do need a Machiavellian streak.
Well, that may be true. There was a comparable issue with the Catalan secessionists. You know, there were many people that were critical of the Catalan secessionist movements on the grounds, well, it's just going to be another province of the European Union. So what's the point? You know, there's
this... same with Scotland. The Scottish secessionist movement was primarily anti-English, but they were kind of soft on immigration.
Yeah, you know, well, my feeling about it is I like these kinds of things because they do legitimize this idea of secession. You know, whatever I think of the politics of the particular group involved, it's more about legitimizing the idea that I tend to be sympathetic to. There's also another tendency that I'm interested in. There's this group called Startup Societies Foundation that's about they're kind of like secessionists, only they're a little bit more radical. They're about forming alternative societies that strive for independence, everything from, you know, makeshift nations that are on seasteads floating in the ocean to smart cities to communes to eco-villages and microstates and all of these kinds of things. And this is beyond merely seceding from a larger state. It's sort of like building an alternative infrastructure within states, or that can actually become independent at some point. And a lot of the groups or models that they cited as examples are things I don't really care for per se, but it's more just the concept that I find interesting.
Yeah, that's the thing with America, is these European secessionist movements are based on people living in a region for a long time. With the United States, United States is a very transient nation, especially here in California, but even where you were in Virginia, there's tons of transplants from the Northeast. So a secessionist movement, some secessionist movements are going to be based in history, but the United States is a very transient movement, and that's going to create a tension if there were a secessionist movement. Even if there were, I mean, there's talk of a Texas secessionist movement, but there's going to be, if that were to happen, there would be the right-wing white secessionist, or there might be some Mexican secessionist. So United States is a very transient country, and that creates a lot of confusion if we talk about pan-secessionism.
Yeah, totally. Which is one of the reasons why I'm not a big proponent of the whole states' rights thing as an end unto itself. I tend to be more into the idea of decentralizing power as far as it can go, like through the principle of free association and local autonomy. And that way you can have, in Texas, you can have communities that are more the, you know, conservative Texan type communities, as well as the Latino, you know, type, you know, Mexican oriented communities as well. I tend to take more of that kind of an angle, because I Virginia is a good example. You know, I in Virginia has actually was once a deep red state. Now it's become a blue state, and largely that has to do with the growth of the Northern Virginia area, like the area just to the south of Washington, D.C. You have a lot of people who actually work in D.C., government bureaucrats and all of that, who live in Northern Virginia, and that, and as well as, you know, because that region's a major commercial center as well. It has the best economy in the United States. It's the most economically prosperous region in the United States. And for that reason, they have turned the entire state blue. Even though in the much of the rest of the state, you know, that much of the rest of the state is deep red, except for some of the larger cities, which tend to be majority black, like the capital, Richmond, where I live, and then the cities on the Tidewater region on the coast.
And the same thing's happening with North Carolina. I mean, Charlotte is a major center of finance. You have the whole Research Triangle. So in the whole southeastern region, there's this concept of the Old South, which is left behind economically, and the New South, which is more economically prosperous, but also more liberal and more diverse.
Yeah, well, that issue's been going on for a long time. I mean, that issue goes all the way back to the Civil Rights era. So the whole dichotomy between the Old South and the New South just really hasn't, it really isn't anything new at all. One thing, though, that I have noticed is that Southern nationalism, I actually think, is at an all-time low. I think that's actually less popular in the South now than it has been at any time in the past. And there are reasons, but I think the main reason is, like, as you were saying, more and more people being transplanted from elsewhere. You have more and more people who aren't originally from the South living in the South. You've also seen the Hispanic population grow significantly in the South in recent years as well. So that, all of that, is going to undermine this whole idea of Southern nationalism, obviously.
Yeah, and just in these big metropolitan regions, so Virginia is divided between, you have the whole sort of Jerry Falwell scene in Lynchburg, You have the hillbilly culture in Appalachia. You have blacks in Richmond. You have the suburbs of D.C. And you could even look at New York, San Francisco, Bay Area, and L.A. And those regions have many different cultures. I mean, if the Bay Area, for instance, was to become its own independent city state, within that, there would just be so many different cultures, it would be difficult to govern.
Yeah. Well, back in the late 60s, Norman Mailer had this idea for an independent New York City. And what he wanted to do was decentralize power to the neighborhood level, to the individual boroughs and things like that, like Queens and Harlem and Manhattan and all of that in Brooklyn and in New York, and essentially have New York as an independent. He didn't want New York to leave the United States, but he wanted it to be the 51st state, and then all of these different boroughs in New York would actually be like local governments.
And, yeah, that would solve a lot of resentment, because what was happening, and this is still happening today in major cities, is blacks felt resentment about white police officers in their communities, and then whites were angry about their schools being impacted by busing with blacks and Hispanics pouring in. So his solution would address both concerns.
Yeah, and that was a big part of his platform. When he was trying to pursue this, those were the big issues at the time. Police brutality in the black community was a big issue, and busing. This was just when the school integration programs were starting in the late 60s. That was a big issue in the white community. So yeah, it's a way of addressing both issues.
And since we were talking about Trump, I think the last show we did about Trump was prior to the election, but on most issues, Trump has pretty much been a mainstream Republican, but then every now and then he steps out and does something. So recently he he came out in favor of tariffs, and that caused his financial advisor who I think was a former hedge fund manager, Gary Cohn, to quit. So Trump has this, he does genuinely have an anti-establishment streak to him, but the problem is, in order to get things done, he has to collaborate with the Republican Party.
Yeah, well, Trump has always been an economic nationalist. If you go back...
Yeah, he even wrote that article back in the 80s under Reagan.
Yeah, he's always had that perspective. That's something he's been consistent about his whole life. He's flip-flopped on a lot of other stuff, but on that, yeah, he's always been fairly consistent, an economic nationalist. So it's not surprising that he would have views of that type, in the White House. I agree, though, that he has, for the most part, governed as a mainstream Republican, and I thought that would be the case. I know when he was running for the presidency, he did an interview with Megyn Kelly at one point where he was talking about things he wanted to accomplish if he became president, and he was saying, rebuild the military and tax cuts, and those are just standard brand Republican talking issues there. I mean, that's all Republicans have talked about for 40 years is rebuilding the military and tax cuts. He's definitely pursued, I'd say the bulk of his policies that he's pursued are what any Republican would have pursued. Let's say one of the other guys that were running in the Republican primaries got elected, they would be doing more or less what Trump is doing, with the exception of a few things. Tariffs is one, yeah. But one thing, though, I will say about Trump is that on foreign policy, he, on one hand, has continued what some of his predecessors have done, like Obama and George Bush. For example, he's escalated the drone wars and stuff like that. He's been a foreign policy hawk. But he has yet, now he's only been in office for a little over a year, so he has a ways to go, but he has yet to really get into any major foreign policy screw-up the way some of his predecessors did.
Yeah, basically he's kept us in Afghanistan, but at the very least he hasn't started a new war, which I can give him some credit for.
Yeah, he's kind of maintained the status quo in Afghanistan, but he hasn't gotten into major screw-ups like Syria or Libya under Obama, or like Iraq and Afghanistan under George W. Bush. He hasn't really started any new wars.
The whole Syria thing with him doing the airstrikes, at the time I was disappointed in him, but I don't think he was even that serious about toppling Assad. I think he did it purely for symbolic reasons.
Yeah, although a while back, Rex Tillerson actually came out and said that he was in favor of removing Assad from power. So there may be some issues there. What's interesting, though, is that I've actually seen in the neocon press, I've seen a lot of criticisms of Trump for going against the neocon agenda. They think he's too soft on Russia, obviously. They also, though, have criticized his anti-ISIS strategy. Like, the neocons have said that he's been too sympathetic to Russia and Iran's efforts to eliminate ISIS. And they're arguing that, that's going to strengthen Russia and Iran in the process, which they're more concerned about than ISIS or any of these other Sunni terrorist groups. So that's interesting to consider. I think that the Trump administration, I don't buy into all the conspiracy theories about how the Russians installed Trump and all that. That's silly. But I do think, though, that his administration is less hostile to Russia than a normal Republican administration or Democratic administration would have been. So that's something else to consider. But one thing that I think is particularly interesting is the fact that he's agreed to meet with Kim Jong-un. That could actually turn out, I mean, I don't know if it will, but it could turn out to be a Nixon goes to China moment.
Absolutely. I mean, a full-on neoconservative would never agree to that.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm sure when that happens, if it happens, that the neocons will go crazy about it. But it'll be interesting to see what comes out of that as well. I think that's definitely something to follow. I think what's happening there is I think the Kim regime basically just wants to survive. That's all they really care about. I think that they've been making some peace initiatives towards the South Koreans, possibly for the purpose of playing them off against the Americans. And they may be looking at it like, okay, if the Americans are going to take a hard line against us, then we're going to start extending the olive branch to the South Koreans, and that way we can perhaps drive a wedge between the Americans and the South Koreans. Maybe the South Koreans will pressure the Americans to back off. It kind of looks like to me that's what's happening there. But the fact that Kim Jong-un wants to meet with Trump, I do think is interesting. It does remind me of the Mao Zedong's initiatives to Nixon in the early 70s. So we'll have to see what comes out of that.
We are getting close to the end of the show. Is there anything else you'd like to add about our first topic on the Best Buy scandal and the collaboration between federal law enforcement and corporations that you didn't touch upon?
Well, just that what we see is this paradigm developing where, because the government has the Constitution that is technically restraining the surveillance powers of the state and things like that, what they are trying to do is find ways of getting around that, and farming out state repression to the private sector is a big part of that. Yeah, it's the same thing they do in foreign policy, where they recruit mercenary organizations like Eric Prince's organizations as part of all of that. And I think we're going to probably see more of that in the future, more and more trying to farm out state repression to the private sector, particularly when it comes to technology. Because of the importance of technology and the level of skill and all that's involved in that. So I think more and more we'll see collusion between technology companies and the government and federal law enforcement, not only for the purpose of investigating crime, but also for the purpose of surveilling dissidents and things of that nature. So that's definitely something to watch out for.
Just look at all these social media sites. There's people focus mostly on the issue of censorship, but I'm sure Facebook and Twitter have big documents on political dissidents that they could hand over to federal law enforcement. Not only that, I mean, these technology institutions are becoming agencies in their own right. that rival the FBI.
Oh yeah, yeah, and that's definitely an area of concern. I mean, the Facebook now, YouTube, all these technology companies have as much censorship power as any government does. You know, even if the government can't move in and shut down websites and things like that, the technology companies certainly can. So I think that the big issue there is perhaps we need to expand the jurisprudence, you know, First Amendment jurisprudence. When the Constitution was first put together, it didn't apply to the states and localities. It was considered to only apply to the federal government. And what's largely happened since then is that through a series of Supreme Court decisions, the Bill of Rights has been extended to the state and federal, to the state and local governments as well as the federal government. And the reason for that, I think, is legitimate in the sense that increasingly as the federal government has become more powerful, the states and localities have largely become just administrative units of the federal government. So it's appropriate that the jurisprudence would change as well. And I think that's true of the corporations and the universities as well. More and more, in fact, not for quite a while, in fact, the corporations have been the economic branch of government, just like the universities are the education branch of government. So extending First Amendment jurisprudence to those, I think, is appropriate.
Keith Preston, it's been an excellent show. Thank you so much for being on.
Thank you.